My name is Bob. I'm a sexual being, and I have a story.
We are all sexual beings, and we all have a story.
You make me want to be a better man.
This is the Sexuality Stories Podcast with sexologist Dr. Jill McDevitt, where everyday people let you in on both the titillating salaciousness and mundane ordinariness that is human sexuality.
Hi, I'm Dr. Jill, and on this episode of Sexuality Stories, my guest Bob shares his personal experience with the grim reality of life before Roe v. Wade and the right to a safe, legal abortion.
The desperation these young women faced in being pregnant and not wanting to be pregnant and risking their lives or losing their lives.
He remembers all too well a world in which sex ed was non-existent.
The school also provided us with zero sex education.
Access to birth control was deeply restricted.
In the 1960s, birth control pills were still really new. It actually took litigation for women other than married women to have access to them. You know, condoms were behind the counter in the drugstore. So it was really hard for single women to avoid becoming pregnant.
And self-induced abortion was frequently deadly.
Now I'm working in a hospital. I was in the finance department, and one of the things that I did every day was to review the admissions from the previous day and the discharges from the previous day. And very quickly, I noticed that there were young women coming in. The admitting diagnosis was something like incomplete abortion, and it was bad enough they were admitted to the hospital. Not all of them lived.
I've known Bob for years as a friend and fellow activist around reproductive rights, but this was the first time I got to hear him share his story about his role in an underground abortion referral network in the 1970s before Roe v. Wade, where he helped connect women in need of abortions with doctors who would perform them safely.
You know, I just felt very drawn to their circumstance and, you know, the extreme unfairness of the laws in our society. So I agreed to do it. And it was essentially being part of the underground.
His story reminds us of the human cost of denying pregnant people agency over their reproductive choices and what could easily become our modern reality if we forget our history. Let's have a listen.
I was really interested in your story as it particularly relates to your involvement in reproductive rights. So I guess maybe to start at the beginning, what interested you in this area of our humanity?
Well, I guess I should sort of frame this just slightly. So I went to Girard College, if you may be acquainted with that, in Philly.
Yeah.
As a student, when I was there, it was all boys. And it was boarding, so there were no girls around. And the school also provided us with zero sex education.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, before the Internet. So, you know, what you got was, you know, sort of anecdotal from whatever sources.
Mm-hmm.
I graduated from there. I started at Penn State. And the first year, my first semester, I was taking a class in sociology. And one of the topics that came up was abortion. They wanted the professor wanted to have a debate about something. And I said, yeah, I'd be on the, I would take abortion as a topic and I would be in favor of it, or not opposed to it, either way you want to put it. And that was the first time that I really had to think about abortion. And, of course, this was years before Roe, so it was illegal then. So it was all sort of theoretic. And skip ahead, in 1972, I started working at a hospital in western Pennsylvania, at Altoona. And that was before Roe. So in the 1960s, you know, I finished high school, birth control pills were still really new. It actually took litigation for women other than married women to have access to them. They were pretty primitive by, you know, 21st century standards, and, you know, heavy doses and so forth, you know, side effects, although those have never gone away. But, you know, condoms were behind the counter in the drugstore. So, you know, in the context of the 60s and so forth, it was really hard for single women to avoid being pregnant or becoming pregnant, had to rely on condoms for the most part, or, you know, things that didn't work very well. And there were a lot of unintended pregnancies. So now I'm working at a hospital. I was in the finance department, and one of the things that I did every day was to review the admissions from the previous day and the discharges from the previous day. And it was a big hospital. There were probably 80 to 100 patients turning over every day, 80 in, 80 out, or something like that. And very quickly, I noticed that there were young women coming in. The admitting diagnosis was something like incomplete abortion or something like that. And I became aware that that meant they had done something at home, or someone had done something to them somewhere. And it was bad enough they went to the ER, came in, were admitted to the hospital for medical staff, the surgeon, to, you know, clean up the mess. Not all of them lived. You know, we had sepsis and so forth. And so I was aware of that in a much more real way. The hospital had it was 550 beds. So we had a chaplain, a department actually, and the chaplain was active in the clergy community and had interns. So if you were going to a seminary to be a priest or a minister or a rabbi, part of your education would be a rotation at a hospital to learn how to be a chaplain or minister to patients in hospitals. So at any given time, he had, you know, four, five, six of those. We became friends, had lunch together, et cetera. And one day he said, we haven't talked about this directly, but I think I understand your views on abortion, and I have something I want to ask you. So we had this conversation about what was then known as the Clergy Counseling Service. And you can Google that. It was a thing. Do you know about it?
I've not heard this term. No, I have no idea what that is.
Well, back in the 60s, there were a number of clergy in, I want to say Chicago. I might not have that right. I think I do. In New York and Chicago. And they were seeing the consequences of illegal abortions, back alley, if you want to use the term, whatever. And they were aware of the desperation these young women faced in being pregnant and not wanting to be pregnant, and risking their lives or losing their lives by seeking something that was illegal. A number of those clergy decided that they would find real doctors, real healthcare providers who would be willing to provide that service, even though it was illegal, and that they would be the buffer. They would be the referral service, so that it wasn't, you know, somebody, you know, in the classic was somebody knew somebody who knew somebody, and you get a phone number and you'd meet at a phone booth or something, and you'd be blindfolded and go someplace you didn't know where. And it was a motel or somebody's kitchen table. And so what they wanted to do was to have real medical providers provide that as a real medical service and protect them from detection.
That's interesting, coming from a Catholic tradition. It's not at least today, known, you know, for being the conduit for access. You know, they tend to be very anti-abortion. So
yeah.
What was that? Has that changed in your experience, or was that?
This was multi-denominational. There were rabbis. The chaplain that I was working with was a Baptist minister.
Oh, okay.
Not Southern Baptist, but the more traditional Baptist. But they were, you know, Lutherans and, you know, Episcopalians and whatever, and Catholics as well. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just Catholics by any means. But the clergy counseling service, was a little more public. I don't mean billboards, but, they made it known within their communities that young women could confidently and confidentially approach their minister, who would then help them find a provider and not risk their life. And so that's what was this particular fellow that I was working with. And he said he'd been doing this for some, I don't know, but for some number of years. He said the problem at the moment, that moment, was that all of his interns were from a Catholic seminary. And he said, I try to involve my interns in everything I do, and this has become awkward. And would I take it over? The referral part. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, does the hospital know you're doing this? And he said, no, they don't. And they'd probably fire me if they found out. And it wasn't a Catholic hospital, but community, had a community board, and, you know, it was a small town. So, you know, there was a lot of uncertainty about that. And that's, you know, looking at it today, that's one of the Trump parts of Pennsylvania. So I agreed to do it. And it was essentially being part of the underground. We had a list of, now this was 1972. So in 1970, the state of New York made abortion legal. So you could go to New York and have that done, and it was legal. And there were clinics available. Washington, D.C., because their city government is actually overseen by the federal government, nothing had ever been done to pass a law outlawing abortion.
Mm-hmm.
So in the absence of a prohibition, clinics opened up in Washington, D.C. So I had a list of, it wasn't a long list, but I had a list of clinics and their prices and who to contact and how to, you know, access. This was all by phone, of course, back then. And where to stay, you know, what it was, you know, what the procedures were like, et cetera. And I had a separate list of people from our community who were willing to provide financial help for anyone who was unable to afford the trip or the procedure. And because of the sort of the character of the job that I had in finance, I interviewed and met with patients all day long. So having women, young women coming into my office to meet with me was very ordinary, and no one really thought anything about it. So
this
that
was a personal risk for you. This was, you had a lot to lose.
I was married. Yeah, I was married. I had two kids and a mortgage and all that. But I just, you know, I just felt very drawn to their circumstance and, you know, the extreme unfairness of the laws in our society and how that was set up. So of course Roe was decided in 1973, but that didn't mean that the next morning there were, clinics available in Pennsylvania, so the referral process continued. I will say that in probably the after New York passed their law, in about that same time period, 72-73, some of the clinics were, they were all private then, but some of the clinics would actually advertise on billboards in Pennsylvania.
Hmm.
So there were, you know, in the State College area where Penn State is and various other college towns and, you know, Interstate 80 and the Turnpike and stuff. It wasn't like they were back to back, but there were billboards to say, you know, legal abortion, New York, phone number, so forth. So, you know, that was how I was drawn in. And around the same period of time, 73 or so, the hospital opened up a Planned Parenthood clinic. So Planned Parenthood, as it exists today, was legally structured in a different form, and there was the identity of it. They weren't an abortion provider then, but they had, you know, family planning, birth control, etc. And so my hospital opened up a Planned Parenthood clinic, separate, physically separate, down the street from the hospital. And because of what I did in finance, I got involved in their billing setup and a lot of the administrative, the computer system and so forth.
Did the hospital ever find out about your underground pre-legal referral program?
No, they never did.
No.
No, they never did.
I'm kind of outnumbered, or there's not as many men as maybe you would like out there doing this.
Well,
work.
Not as many men as there should be.
Mm-hmm.
The kind of skipping to the present, I went on the board of Planned Parenthood here in Westchester. 1997, so 22 years ago. And I was one of probably four or five men on the board.
Mm-hmm.
We were less than half, maybe a third of the board were men. So the boards, and I did several terms in Westchester. I did several more terms on the one in Philadelphia, and it's probably about a quarter to a third of the board is men. And we have a finance committee that I serve on, and at the moment, I'm the only man on the board. I'm also a clinic escort, and that's about half and half. And we have a state, the Planned Parenthood in Pennsylvania has a statewide political action committee, a PAC, and I'm on that board. And there are three men on that board out of more than 20 in total. So fewer. I don't think of that as meaningful, that it should be more or that it's unusual that it's less. It kind of is what it is. I think if it was no men, I would be bothered by that. But.
Sorry, I mentioned it. Maybe you think about something you hadn't thought about.
You know, unless you're Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who thinks there should be 9 women on the Supreme Court. And I happen to agree with her, but. So I guess my early 20s, I was involved in a very personal way with the real life risks and the real life, challenges that young women face. and, you know, the stigma and so forth. I mean, Altoona was, you know, there was a Catholic hospital across town. Catholic Church was a major influence in the community. And, you know, it would have been very controversial if all of that had been made public. But it was, you know, it just something that I felt, you know, I just felt drawn to, felt that it was important. And, you know, if it's something I could do, and I did.
I wish more people were like that, taking personal risks. Yeah, I mean, that's really, I think that's really incredible.
Yeah. In that, by the way, in that same time period, I mean, I was out here, you know, out in Western Pennsylvania. I was involved in the profession that I became part of, and we had statewide meetings, some of which were in Pittsburgh or Philadelphia. When I came to Philadelphia, back then there was Philadelphia General Hospital. It's not there anymore. But I remember talking to my, you know, my counterpart who had the same job at that hospital, and he talked about the sepsis ward, which meant that there were so many women with septic shock or the, you know, medical aftermath of an attempted abortion or, you know, self-induced, that they ended up in the hospital, and there were so many of them, they had a separate ward for them. And that was true in a lot of other cities.
I feel like, tell me if this resonates with you, I feel like the pushback that is continues to be around abortion is from people who don't remember this, who never saw this, who don't remember a time in which people were dying and that there were sepsis wards for these home abortions gone awry. Does that feel true for you in your experience?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. certain number of the people that I'm involved with inside Planned Parenthood who are, let's just say, of a certain age, meaning the age that I am, who do remember, and we talk about the fact that our children, certainly our grandchildren, grew up with no knowledge, no direct experience, no exposure to any of those things. You know, my kids are in their 50s, but by the time they were in first grade, Roe was already decided. So, you know, that was never something that they had to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole, you know, the American culture has evolved. I mean, the 60s with counterculture and, you know, hippies and the whole sort of social revolution really did make a difference. And, you know, feminism and the women's rights movement and so forth have made a difference. You know, it's regrettable that we're still fighting a lot of the same fights, but there are differences. You know, kind of the opposite end of this is something that literally doesn't exist anymore. So if you were pregnant in 1970, and you were either terrified and unwilling to take your life in your hands to have an abortion that was illegal, or it was something you just didn't believe in, there were facilities, hospitals around the country, including in Philadelphia on City Line Avenue, and most of them were known as the Florence Crittenden Homes. I think they had other names. They were run by the Salvation Army.
Okay.
And they were buildings. I mean, these were like, you know, apartments or nursing homes. And so young women who became pregnant, but who couldn't live in their homes and communities while they were pregnant because of the stigma, would go away. And where they were going was to one of these facilities. Some of them provided education, some of them didn't, keep you going in high school and so on. But you would live there during your pregnancy. They had their own little maternity hospital where you would deliver. And when that was done, then you would go back home and they would place the babies for adoption. And of course, those buildings and the services and so forth disappeared decades ago. But, adoption has changed too. And, we have, lots of foster care, but we don't have orphanages the way that they existed back then. And I think that probably had an influence on me because Girard is essentially an orphanage and that's how I grew up. So, if you sort of understand the whole, the 360 of life in those days for young women, it's like, well, if you put it in contemporary context, at whatever age, the average, I guess, now is first sexual experience is 17. Mm-hmm. I think it's gone up a little bit, but most men and women have had sex before they finish high school. And no one thinks a lot about it because, you can avoid being pregnant in a number of ways, and many of them are very confidential and free. And of course, that's something Planned Parenthood does. Mm-hmm. But you have more awareness, even if you're getting your sex education off the internet in ways that are significantly inappropriate in many cases. Mm-hmm. There's still more information. I mean, that was the thing. We didn't get sex ed. And that was not uncommon. So you have young women in the 1960s, 70s, not very well informed. Maybe their mothers, maybe their parents were helpful and honest with them and sort of complete. I don't think that that was the case. The girls that I dated certainly didn't seem to have a lot of knowledge. And it wasn't easy to avoid becoming pregnant. And of course, the consequences always fell on the women. And that's not untrue now, mm-hmm. but at least there are more options available.
I think you provide such a really important framework for understanding this conversation through a modern lens. Do you feel like where do you feel like we're at with abortion access and reproductive rights? Is there progress? Are we doing better? Are we slipping back? What's your sense of it?
It's tenuous. Hmm. So this year, 2019, this year, which we just finished the third month, there have been 250 different bills introduced in state legislatures and the U.S. Congress, 250 bills to eliminate or severely restrict access to abortion. So, in the last week, Georgia passed one that says 6 weeks. Most women, you miss a period and, you're a week late. That happens. You're 2 weeks late. Now you're starting to wonder. And now the clock has run out on when you can have an abortion in Georgia.
Yeah.
And so it's under attack. I think that this administration has emboldened a lot of those who oppose abortion. The troublesome thing to me is that across the United States, percentages in the 70s of Americans walking around saying, I approve of abortion, whether I approve it for myself, I understand why it should be available. And right. I approve of it being available and safe. So you have a very small minority, a third, who are opposed in some form, some of them intensely, some not so, who are trying to dominate our culture and reverse the access that has been more available for 40 plus years. So, I mean, there are states like New York where that's not the case. And California and other, you know, some other states. But when you get into the so-called red states, it's bad and getting worse.
So how does this minority get to have this much power, not only politically, but also the public conversation, right? It's almost dangerous to post. Every time I post about abortion on my professional social media pages, I will get, you know, people pushing back in ways that they don't about any other topic that I write about around sexuality. So how are they so powerful in their minority?
Well, it's mostly because of the political tone that we have today. The Republican Party has essentially sold that part of their soul to the religious right, to the, you know, evangelicals and fundamentalists as a way to keep them in their voting camp. I mean, it's sort of analogous to, the National Rifle Association. So it's sort of the, if you support our candidates, if you support our policies, we will do your bidding as much as we can. And it's a debt that they're paying. And that's pretty much what's happening. Now, you could say, all right, so Texas, are most of the citizens in Texas opposed to abortion personally? Well, I lived in Texas for a little while, and Southern Baptist is the dominant church down there. And I would say there's certainly a much higher percentage in Texas who oppose abortion than in Pennsylvania. But is it a majority? I don't think it is. I think, again, it's the political candidates and the fact that the Republican Party has been sort of co-opted, because they have, you know, the Senate and the White House and in many states, the House, the Senate and the governor, like Ohio and some others, they just keep ramming these through. And of course, a significant number of these pieces of legislation all came out of the same printer. There's an organization that does this. It's sort of cookie cutter. They serve it up to their supporters in each of the legislatures, and you'll read the same language, even the same punctuation mistakes in their bills. But, you know, if they pass them, they're the law. A lot of them are aimed at becoming the test case that finally gets to the Supreme Court and overturns Roe. And the number of them aren't even bashful about admitting that that's what they're intending. So
how likely is Roe to be overturned?
Wow. 5 years ago, I would have said not very likely. Now, I think I'm not going to say it's inevitable. I just think that it's a coin toss.
I could cry. Like, that is, what does that do for you to think that?
I've had actually many conversations about that. I did this before.
Right. You've seen what happens.
Yeah. But I know how to run an underground network when it was all paper and telephone.
So presumably it'd be easier now with digital.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. And, you know, the difference is that, New York and a number of other states have now passed new legislation that essentially protects choice in their state. Even if Roe is overturned, it will remain legal in New York, for example. New York passed something early this year that was blown way out of proportion by the opponents. But they did it, and there are other states where it was passed years ago, and the enabling law is on their books, so even if Roe is overturned, it will be legal in about 13 states. The problem, of course, is that that makes it accessible to the residents of those, the women in those states, and anyone who can afford to travel to those states. But in huge swaths of the country, there's going to be no availability. And, you know, the poorer you are, the more stuck you are, you know, the more vulnerable you are. And I think that's when we see people going back to do-it-yourself solutions. Now that there are medical abortions available, you know, now essentially those things are going to turn into workarounds and homemade solutions to something that shouldn't require a solution in the first place. So, you know, that's the fantasy on the other side is, well, if we make it illegal, they'll all go away. And of course, that isn't the case at all. In fact, the, you know, birth control works. The rate of abort, the number of abortions year over year over year is going down. There are some dramatic examples, such as in Denver, where the state health department and the state government created a campaign to promote birth control, not abstinence, birth control and access to it, and IUDs and longer acting birth control methods for young women. And the rate of unintended pregnancies dropped by 40%. In high school aged women. So, you know, sex education, birth control, those things work. And even though they're not perfect and there are still failures of birth control, intentional birth control, it reduces the number. And then we have the people on the other side who just become hysterical that there's no such thing as a bad pregnancy.
Ooh, yeah. I mean, we know the data, right? We have such good data about sex education and birth control. But you can't, you know, the fact argument doesn't help when they're operating from this emotional framework and they just cannot be reasoned with. What? Okay, so the politicians are in bed with the religious right. Why does the religious right care about abortion? Like other places on in the world, right? Other countries, like this is a non-issue. Like they don't have yearly political debates about abortions. This is just not the center of their politics in the ways that it's very much a center of ours. Is this an American phenomenon? Is this a sexism issue? Is this a sex phobia? Why is this a thing, in your opinion?
I think that, you know, if you sort of focus on the Catholic element of it, there's a portion of that if they just fundamentally, as part of their religion, are opposed to abortion. Well, okay. If that's part of your belief system and that's what you want to use to govern your life, that's perfectly fine with me. When you want to impose that on me or my granddaughters, when they don't share those beliefs in any way, I have a problem with that because yours is coming from religion and you've conflated it into something so that you don't have to admit that it's religious. So, you know, I think that it is the last gasp, but right now anyway, what seems to be a successful effort to revive, you know, puritanical, you know, Victorian morals that kind of never existed in the first place. They're trying to create something that is their, you know, sort of their fantasy, even though it never really took place. So,
those good old days that never were, so called.
Yeah. This is personal to me, not just from the early days. My daughter grew up in my house, and her mother and I had the beliefs that, you know, are consistent with what I've been saying. So she went to a Catholic college. She went to Villanova. She was a patient of Planned Parenthood, and we knew it. And I was like, well, that's great. She's doing the responsible thing. she's taking care of herself. And, you know, that's important. Well, you know, we now have 9 granddaughters. And they're all in their teens and 20s except one. And I don't need to know, but I know sort of anecdotally that most of them are patients of Planned Parenthood. And at least one case is also the friend who takes her girlfriends to Planned Parenthood. And I'm very proud of that because, you know, it means that they understand themselves. They've made it a point to become responsible. And it, you know, in the bigger picture to me, it says they have taken control of their own personal agency. You know, that's the, you know, because I'm old enough, having seen the 60s and 70s and so forth, you know, in the 60s, you know, the girls that were graduating from high school when I did, going into college when I did, you know, their goals were, you're going to be a nurse, you're going to be a teacher. Now you're going to be whatever you want to be. And it wasn't that there aren't examples of women becoming astronauts and things from those early days, but they were exceptional. They were remarkable. And now that's not remarkable. And a lot of that had to do with the fact that, well, you know, you're going to get pregnant and, you know, it's all over. My mother grew up in a really small town out in western Pennsylvania. She was very smart, but she graduated from high school in 1926. And one of her uncles lived in Pittsburgh and said, I will pay for her to go to college. It wasn't that expensive back then. She can live with us and go to college. And my grandfather forbid it. He said, she's just going to get married and have babies, and that's a waste of time and money for her to get an education. So she never did.
Which is why, to me, the abortion issue is very much misogynist, right? Opposing abortion, because it's really opposing the agency and the opportunity that you just speak of that pregnancy can get in the way of if that's not what you want.
So now, you know, you have ways to make sure that you're not going to get pregnant. And even despite your best intentions and efforts, something goes wrong and you are pregnant and you're not ready right now. You can end that and it's safe. You're not risking your life to do that. And that's really important to our society. We have a great granddaughter. So.
Wow, look at you.
Yeah.
All the women.
Well, yeah, I have 9 granddaughters and 1 great granddaughter. We do have two grandsons, but it's so important to me to protect this because I have very clear memories of what it was like when what we have or potentially have today didn't exist. And, you know, how much it impaired the lives of women or ended them. And, you know, it's a very moralistic, and classist attitude. When I escort here in the town where I live, not far from your store.
Yeah, I know that Planned Parenthood.
You know, we have as many as 90 protesters in front of the clinic from the local Catholic church.
Oh, I know that Catholic church very well too.
Yes, you do.
Is it the same one that, yeah.
Yeah, the very one. Now, I don't think that the people out in front are all millionaires, but I would say that all of them are middle class. None of them would fit the profile of someone living, you know, in a single mother, you know, single parent household, somebody who's poor, somebody who's living, you know, just above or just below the poverty line. They're not the ones out front protesting.
No.
So they don't have any moral connection.
And if they need an abortion, they can go through their private doctor and their insurance will cover it. So they don't.
Well, or Planned Parenthood.
Planned Parenthood.
We had an example where.
Oh, tell us the story.
One of the more vociferous and agitated protesters who was out there week after week called our clinic one day and said, my daughter is, my 16-year-old daughter is pregnant. And the person on our Planned Parenthood then said, well, fine, just, you know, do you want to make an appointment? Do you want to walk in? What would you like? She said, well, I need a referral to a source for an abortion that isn't you. It isn't in your clinic. I can't be seen bringing my daughter into your clinic. I have to go where nobody knows me.
Now, after the fact, was she back?
2 weeks later, she was right back out front.
Did she have a sign? Was she yelling things? What kind of things was she
saying? Oh, yeah. She was not there to support us, as you can imagine. So.
Holy cognitive dissonance. Wowie.
Yeah.
That says, I bet you won unplanned pregnancy that you're secretly pro-choice. Right? Like, until you need it.
That's right.
Until you need it, then it's fine. But other people must be evil and all these other things.
Yeah. And, you know, the statistics tell us that the average woman coming to have an abortion, Planned Parenthood or the other, Planned Parenthood does about 40% of the abortions in the United States, and that means that we don't do 60% of them. They're done by private practices, hospitals, et cetera. We're the target, but but the average woman coming in for an abortion is already a mother and has 1.567 children. This is a family situation. This is a real life thing. This is the, I can't afford the two children I have, never mind a third one. And I was careful, or as careful as I could be, to not get pregnant, but it happened anyway.
Yeah.
And nobody's raised
their
hand.
And there's so many stories and so many reasons.
Yeah.
Can you tell some more stories about your experiences with being an escort? And what that is and what you do and what you've seen?
Well, you know, I think the situations, you have a national audience, so I think the circumstances are maybe not typical everywhere, but the clinic that I escort for, we have a sort of a drive-up parking area, so part of the property is paved for patient parking, and there's a line painted on the street where the sidewalk would be, and inside that is private property. The protesters try to be numerous enough to impede access, to impede entry into the parking. Now that's actually illegal. So
I was gonna
we have
say,
had
is that
on,
legal?
No, it's not. We have had to call the police to, you know, have them enforce that. They all know what the rules are. We have to, as escorts, you know, try to use our bodies. You know, we have an official policy of non-engagement. We don't talk to them. We'll say, you know, get out of the way or look behind you or something to make, you know, for safety reasons. But we're not going to stand there and debate with them ever. But, you know, we have to, you know, kind of do things to move them out of the way. And if they persist, and that has happened a few times, there's actually a federal law that's called FACE. And I think it's the Federal Access to Clinics. I forget what the E is. So there's actually an enforceable federal law that if you physically impede access, you can actually be arrested, and, you know, by a federal officer. And we have cameras, so they know they're being recorded. But we've had incidents. We've had patients coming in. We had a young couple that came in. They drove in, a bunch of protesters out front, parked the car. The girlfriend got out. She starts walking towards the clinic, and they're parked right in front of the building. And, you know, all the yelling and, you know, don't go in there, all that sort of thing. And the gentleman that was with her gets out of the car. He's about 6'4". looks like a biker, you know, has a sleeveless denim jacket on. And one of the protesters, one of the guys, and we know who it is, and you probably know who it is. we'll call him Jack.
I know what you're talking about. Oh my God.
So he starts mouthing off at this guy, you know, be a man and all that. So this guy, you know, pulls himself up, and I'm standing there thinking, and he starts walking down to confront our friend. And I'm thinking, I got to get in between these guys. Otherwise, I'm going to see his head rolling down the street, because I think he could have picked him up and, you know, snapped him in half.
Easily.
So
yeah.
It's that sort of thing. It's real. And, you know, the, you know, harangue, they have leaflets they're pushing because they have one of the fake clinics is a few blocks away. So those things, you know, those are sort of constants. We did get a chuckle not too long ago. A young woman came in on a Saturday somewhere and walked in. She finished her appointment. She was coming back out. You know, we try to make sure that they're, you know, physically safe and get off the property without getting accosted. And one of the protesters was going on and on about her and, you know, abortion and so forth. And she started to walk away and then stopped and turned around and came back. And she said, tell you what, let me share with you the paperwork from my visit for a yeast infection. And it stopped them cold. They didn't know what to say, you know, but it's a reminder that when you walk into a clinic, you know, Planned Parenthood or any other that offers a full range of services, it's nobody's business why you're in there. And many times the reason you're in there has nothing to do with pregnancy. But even if it does, it's none of your business.
Yeah, really. I mean, it's a medical, right? Like, this is a doctor's office. It's a medical clinic.
Yeah.
And it's, oh, wow.
We have, so Planned Parenthood has a new president, Cecile Richards, who was a very charismatic and effective leader for more than a decade, stepped away last year, and they did a search. And our new president is Dr. Lena Wen, who is an MD. And she has begun to reshape our narrative to fully emphasize we are a healthcare provider. That's what we do. You know, there's no reason for this to be a conversation about anything except that we provide healthcare And by the way, an abortion is healthcare, just like
abortion is treating, healthcare, yes.
Just like treating a yeast infection.
Exactly. So,
it comes down to what I said before. It's agency. If we wanted to end unintended pregnancies entirely, and abortions as a byproduct, we just have to make sure that men stop having sex, because
easy peasy.
Yeah, it takes two parties to do that, and everything falls on women, and that's wrong.
That's beautiful. Yes, I think that's it. That's the bottom line. It's the agency, and it's medical, and it's really no one else's business. But I just love how I never knew your story. I was always curious, so I'm glad I asked about what was the personal component for you, and you saw it at its ugliest, and what happens, because people are always going to get abortions. People have always had abortions for thousands of years. It's just a matter of, is it going to be safe? And you helped do that before it was legal. And I just think that's a beautiful story. Thank you for sharing it.
Yeah. I wish I could retire from this, but I won't. And, I at least will say I'm proud that I have inspired my granddaughters to become involved as volunteers. So they're not just patients, they're activists. But it's regrettable that it's even necessary. This should just be like going to the dentist. It shouldn't be anything at all.
Yeah. But we have our American puritanical thing. Right.
And you fight that bigger fight all day, every day.
And we have our work cut out for us. That's for sure.
You've been listening to Sexuality Stories with sexologist Dr. Jill McDevitt, sponsored by you. Thank you so much for subscribing. Want to tell your story on a future episode? Contact Dr. Jill at jill@thesexologist.org.